This is Fragmented, an Android developer podcast where we talk about building good software and becoming better Android developers. I'm Don Felker.
And I'm Kaushik Gopal.
Welcome to episode number 8.
All right. So Don, when I say these words, Android app, top-notch quality, listening to podcasts, what's the first app that comes to your mind?
Usually the first app I recommend to anyone that comes out of my mouth is usually Pocket Cast. Why?
All right. Now, see, because we're both big fans of Pocket Casts, we thought it'll be super cool because the developers from Shifty Jelly, which is the company that makes Pocket Casts, they're super cool guys too. So we reached out to them, and we have one of the developers from Pocket Casts today, Philip Simpson. Welcome to the show, Phil.
Thanks for having me on. It's great to be here.
Yeah, thanks for coming on.
Phil joins us today all the way from Australia, so thank you. The time zone shift must have made it a little difficult, I'm guessing. You have that cup of coffee with you there, Phil?
Yeah, I've already had my coffee. It's we're in the future, so it's a day ahead here, which is great.
Yeah, it's in the evening over here on the Pacific Coast where we're at, and it's, what, the next day it'd be, what, Friday morning for you right now?
Yeah, it's Friday morning, so the coffee's just kicked in. It's good.
So, Phil, do you want to go ahead and just maybe give our listeners a quick introduction as to who you are and what you do in Pocket Casts?
Yeah, sure. So I'm basically a co-founder here at Shifty Jelly, but I'm also the Android developer. Maybe I can tell you a bit about kind of my past and how I got to here. So I used to be an enterprise Java developer, so I've been doing this since 2002. I used to contract for like kind of big companies, so like governments and large organizations. But then back in, I think it was like 2008, I met my co-founder, now Russell. We were working for like a big company. And we decided, God, we enjoyed doing the work in the day, but we wanted to do something a bit more interesting. So in the evenings, we started just developing apps. So at that point in time, the iPhone had just come out. So there was this brand new kind of platform where you could develop your own apps and release them to kind of the world. So that was really exciting to us. So we started, you know, in the evenings, we'd just try out different things. So we thought maybe we could make a weather app. So back then, obviously the app store wasn't very big, so it was quite easy to get noticed. So we made an app in Australia. So it was a Pocket Weather Australia, and it was became quite popular. So that was quite good, you know, just in the evenings in our spare time. And then 2 years later, we discovered that it was actually doing quite well, and we thought, you know, we could actually make this a full-time job, so we could actually do this for a living. So in 2010, I think it was then, we actually decided we're going to leave our full-time jobs and break away. And that was really kind of a big step for us, because obviously it's the safety of your full-time work. And
are you saying enterprise Java development wasn't as interesting as indie house development? I mean, that sounds difficult. I mean, it's hard to believe that.
Well, we were doing like JSPs and JSF and server work. And yeah, that's interesting, you know, from a geek's point of view. But when you get to kind of mobile apps, it's kind of way more exciting. So
JSPs, oh, wow. Yeah. That's like the good stuff there, man.
We didn't get started on Android until it was like a year after we'd kind of gone full time. And it's quite an interesting story, actually, because we kind of heard about the Android platform, but we hadn't really tried it out yet. So we had one of our users who was an iOS user who had bought an Android phone. Mm-hmm. And he was so desperate for us to like move on to the Android platform, he actually posted us an Android phone. So well, one morning this HTC Desire rocked up in the post. And nice. We're like, oh, we've got a phone now. Maybe we should actually try it. So that's when we kind of got started on the Android side.
So you guys originally hopped into this from the iPhone perspective. So did the first version of Pocket Cast come out on iPhone or on Android first?
Yeah, it was on iPhone first. It was kind of the way back then, you know, you do your iPhone version first, and then you kind of do the Android one like second. So yeah, we got started on that. So,
Oh, was this Pocket Weather or was this Pocket Casts, or both of them were iOS first?
Initially, it was we both did both. Initially, it was both of them first. So our first versions of both of them on iOS. But yeah, then later on down the track, you know, that's where that changed. Well, I think when we started on Android, it was Gingerbread. So okay. I think at that point, you know, Apple and iOS, the operating system was slightly kind of ahead of Android. It was Android back then was a little bit of a mess. but yeah, since then, obviously, they've sorted that out.
Cool. So that sounds like a lot of fun. I mean, one of the reasons like we were super thrilled to have you on was I'm sure like most of like the Android developers, designers, and even users, very respected developers, designers, and users in the platform. Recently, you pushed out a material design update for Pocket Casts, and everyone's reveling about it because it's a fantastic update. It's a very thoughtful update, and there are so many things that we would love to chat with you about. But going on a little more on your development sort of environment.
So my development setup, you mean? So I've got on my desk, I've got a Mac Pro. You know, I think one of the big things is, as a programmer, you don't want to be waiting around. So, you know, we got the fastest computers we could afford at the time, and we've worked our way up, and now we've got like Mac Pro. So that's one of kind of the main things I think is kind of important. Because, you know, when you're working for big companies, they give you like a Windows machine, which has got no RAM, and you don't want to be doing that. You need to be, your time is important. So the quicker computer you can get, the better, I think. Also, recently bought a 34-inch, this ultra-wide curved LG monitor. I used to have the two monitors, and it with the two monitors, you always have to have one on the side. So you've got one central and then one on the side. Whereas now with the kind of ultra wide one, you can have kind of the center is actually kind of in the middle of your desks, and it works much better for me. So I have Android Studio in the center, then on the left I might have Slack, and on the right I might have Terminal. Mm-hmm. And yeah, I really like it, and I haven't looked back since. So if you haven't tried one, I'd recommend it.
That's interesting because I think it was last episode or the episode before, Jake Wharton had brought up that he had moved, and so he was working on just one screen, and he found out himself actually being much more productive on one screen. Do you find that still to be the case with such a large monitor at 34 inches, that you're still productive and able to focus on one thing, or is it distracting at all?
I've always found it easier with if I can have like two windows open at once. So rather than having to switch, the same with like two monitors, you can have, you know, you can have your browser open in one and your editor in another, or you can have two editors and I can look between the two. I find if I'm switching, personally myself, I find it harder to keep track of stuff, whereas if it's just next to me. Also with the ultra wide screen, you don't get a full screen either side, so you can just see kind of messages coming, so you can have a quick look, but you can still concentrate on the thing in front of you. I find that's the best for me.
Very
excellent.
Cool.
Yeah, The last few days, I've been going back and forth between basically the laptop, and then just plugging one monitor in and going up to three monitors and trying to see what's best. And I've found out for me, it's kind of been that individual monitor, larger screen monitor, 27 inches, and just having one of those. As soon as I have two, then all of a sudden I have a Slack window going, and then I have another window going, and then all of a sudden Facebook's open somewhere, and I'm like down some rabbit hole that I can't get out of. You know, I'm anti-productivity at that point. So that's interesting. I have to check out the 34-inch monitors. That's pretty cool.
Do you have a high-resolution monitor? Because this one isn't Retina or anything like that, but still, you know, works fine for me.
No, mine are just I have like an Acer monitor and a Samsung monitor that I got on a good deal on Newegg.com.
I got a 27-inch one, but this is like the IPS display, so I guess it's like the Retina sort of equivalent resolution. So it's pretty nice too.
That's awesome.
What's your development setup like, Phil? So when you come in every day to the Shifty Jelly Studios and you decide, okay, today looks like a good day to do Android development, how does it look like? Like if I was to sit beside you and like sort of pair program with you on Android development, do you have like Android Studio up? Do you have like a custom environment? Like give us all the good juicy details.
It's not that juicy, to be honest with you, but I keep Android Studio quite plain. Like, you know, I like a dark theme. I have some keyboard shortcuts set up, but I don't really customize it that much. You know, compared to some people who are really into that, I keep it quite plain. You know, there's a lot of features now being built into Android Studio that kind of help you autocomplete, you know, add your imports automatically, that kind of speed me up enough. I find the thing that slows me down is me rather than the IDE. I think just thinking mm-hmm. about the next problem, how to solve it. I have a few things I do differently. So one thing I often do is I make a little cheat sheets for myself. So when I'm working on Android, I'll make a cheat sheet with things I forget often or things that are useful. So like the screen resolutions or how to create a fragment like a template. So I've heard people talk about live templates, and that's something I should definitely look into. But at the moment now, I just have like a cheat sheet for each one. So I, I, obviously working for ourselves, I do quite a few different things. So I might be doing some server maintenance, or I might be doing some Ruby. So I've got different cheat sheets, so I can, if I'm switching between languages, it kind of speeds me up in that sense.
Nice. And do you have these cheat sheets that you have found like online or stuff, or have you made your own custom cheat sheets?
So they're my own ones, I guess, because it's what I forget. If I've forgotten it twice, I'll put it in the cheat sheet so I don't have to go and hunt for it again. Mm-hmm. You know, when you've done a Google search and you see the same results coming up again and again, you realize that you've visited that page. Maybe it's time to, you need to record that somewhere. So
I do the same thing.
Yeah, so that works for me, and it's my own customized. I haven't put them on the web or open sourced them yet. I should do, but it's quite custom to me, so I don't know whether anyone would find it useful or not. I've tried doing the gists, so I'll put them in gists. So I've got like one for Bash, I've got one for a few other things that kind of help me out. But maybe I'll put them on the web somewhere.
The ones that you do have that are in gists, would those be anything that you'd be willing to share so the listeners could check it out? Do you have any that you'd be okay with sharing?
Yeah, I'll have to quickly go and edit them, make sure they look good. But yeah, make myself look a bit cleverer. I'll put some harder things in there.
There you go.
Yeah, that's the secret to being smart, a smart open sourcer. Just like put stuff that even you don't understand and hope nobody else understands it.
I'll just copy it from the web somewhere. It'd be fun.
Nice. And what devices do you use, Phil? Like when you're in the stage of development, do you typically use, do you have like a go-to device, or do you have like emulators? I remember seeing a tweet from you some time back where like you have a whole bunch of devices arranged in a sort of like grid manner. I'll put a link to that tweet in the show notes.
Yeah, I guess kind of over the time we've built up phones, like there's a new phone come out and we've had to support it. So we've, we've gone out and bought that because at the end of the day, you can these days get away with some of the few core devices, but over time we've bought different ones that have had problems, like some Samsung phones or some HTC phones. Yeah, and it just add up and up. So that picture was like kind of few on my desk. I think at the moment I've got about 8 on my desk, so it's not too many. But when you're going to test, for a final release, if it's a big change, like a PocketCast 5, I wanted to test on as many devices as possible. But day to day, I use the Nexus 5. I find that the best. It has the least amount of logging. Mm-hmm. I've got also a Samsung S5, but that tends to throw out so much logging, it's hard to track kind of what's happening. True. It's not necessarily I always get logging from my own app. There's sometimes it'll be an error where it will come out in a different way. So I really need to be able to follow those logs as well. So the S5 is good for a phone to just, I use that for my podcasting and my normal phone, but actually the Nexus 5 is the best I find for development. I have tried out the Jenny Motion recently. So I did some, it kind of, I should have done it before, but I tried it out recently just to see the speed difference. So I was doing deployments of podcasts. I'd change one file and I'd redeploy, and so on the device it was about 20 seconds, and on Jenny Motion it was 15. So there's definitely a slight improvement in speed with that. But
interesting. Definitely.
I guess it's your personal preference, I guess.
Definitely. And when you say you test the app on various devices, do you have like an automated way of doing that, or do you actually have to like manually test it on each of the devices?
We don't have an automated way. It's generally like when it becomes near a release, we'll actually spend time doing testing. So I'll go on to the Nexus 9, the Nexus 7, and then different sizes, but then going on the older devices as well. So I'll boot up an emulator and try it in an old version of Android, but also we've got some old phones we can try it on. Because sometimes you get funny issues with that, so especially because we deal with kind of media playback as well, which is, if you deal with any edge cases, sometimes it's good to have older devices.
Yeah, because I imagine that would be very dependent on like the hardware vendors, the way they have that implemented, right, those APIs.
Yeah, a lot of our support's kind of that way as well. Like it'll be a media player, which is slightly different on different phones, so you'll get different errors.
Ah, interesting.
Hey, Kaushik, how did you find out about the PocketCast app?
How did I find out? So this is interesting, actually, because there are two ways. I for people who don't really know, I was an iPhone user in the past life. Yes, sacrilege.
But I gotta go, guys.
Oh, God.
I know. Please don't hate me. So, no, yeah. So basically, I was an iPhone user previously. It was during the transition that I got really into podcasts. So I had moved from the iPhone to the Android phone. At that point, basically, one thing that always bummed me out was I could never find really high quality apps like for Android. And because I just moved from iPhone, I always felt that was lacking. So I was actually looking for a really good podcast app. And on Android specifically, if you even like try to Google it or something today, everyone recommends Pocket Cast as being like the best app. So it was actually purely just like Google searching and stuff. And obviously I had, after some time, I had also heard about Pocket Cast being highly recommended by other people from different platforms as well. So that's how, I mean, I heard about Pocket Cast.
It's always interesting to see how people find out about these apps. And I know my introduction to Pocket Cast is probably a little bit different. I've been listening to podcasts since 2004, back, you know, when you had the iPod and you had to connect it to your computer, download everything, transfer the files on Sunday night before you had your commutes on Monday. You know?
Oh, sync on iTunes.
Yes. Oh, it's a nightmare. And so when I had my first, I think I was on the Nexus One, I think I was on. I use an app called Dog Catcher, which is another, another podcast app on Android. And I use that one, but it was all right. And I always felt like it just got the job done and it wasn't perfect. I just felt like something was lacking. And then I actually, one day on a total random whim, I was messing around with my Roku box and I watched I think it was all like This Week in Android. And I think your co-founder, Phil, was on This Week in Android. Is that correct?
Yeah, Russell. Russell, quite likes podcasting, so he's been on quite a few, yeah.
Yeah, so he was on there and he was talking about Pocket Cast, and I was like, oh, what's this? And I went and checked it out, and I just saw that, and this was, I don't know, 2010 maybe? And I saw it, I was like, wow, this looks like a great app, and I installed it, and ever since then, it's just been getting better and better and better. And like Kaushik said, the last update has just been phenomenal, so kudos on that.
Brilliant, thanks for the the plug there.
Yeah, no problem. To be honest, it's the number one app that I recommend everyone as soon as people ask me. I run the Phoenix Android user group, and a lot of times people ask, like, hey, well, what's your favorite five apps, Don? And we kind of ask that at the user group to everyone who comes in, just so people can share. And mine is the first one always out of my mouth. It's Pocket Cast, and I think people that listen to podcasts will quickly find it becomes their favorite, too.
It's so motivating to hear other people say they like your app. You know, you get people all around the world that do that. That's kind of one of the reasons, you know, that's kept us going, you know. It's when you hear people like you or other people on podcasts talk about it, it's really great.
And speaking of which, like you guys, so this isn't like your guys' first app. You guys are, you know, an indie shop. And you said that the Pocket Weather app was kind of really what made you guys realize that there was something here to take it out to the next level. What other apps that have you guys made, guys, since you guys have, you know, kind of come out on your own and been an indie mobile shop?
I'd like to say they've all been like successes, but they haven't. So obviously, we've tried a few different ones like along the way. We had one called Weather Watch, which was like a desktop kind of weather app. Pocket Weather was obviously a first success. It got to number one in Australia.
Oh wow!
It was really focused on Australian weather, and we use Australian weather data, so people saw that. And you know, I think at one point we were on one in five iPhones over here in Australia. So that kind of helped us to get to the next step of actually doing Pocket Cast. We've kind of built it up over the time. It hasn't just been we've gone indie and we've just worked on apps. Initially, we had to do some client work to make ends meet. So,
oh, interesting.
So that's a good question. When you guys did decide to go out on your own, how did you guys spend your time initially? Was it like 10% writing your own apps and then 90% consulting? Because there's a lot of companies that do that. Kind of what's your guys' story? And how did you get to being able to work on your apps full-time? Or the better question is, do you guys work on your apps full time right now?
We do now. In the early days, we didn't. And we had to do client work to kind of make ends meet. And we were trying to do, I guess it makes sense to try and do mobile apps. So your aim is to do apps full time if you can do client work which relates. So initially we started, I was working on a web app for a while. And that didn't really kind of aim towards where we're going. So then we start to take on clients which were kind of mobile apps. And that really kind of helped us out. You know, you're learning more to do with each of the platforms, but then you can also bring that back to your own apps as well.
So now you guys have been out doing this for a little while. Is it just you and Russell, or do you guys have any other employees at work at your company? Or do you guys outsource, or how does that work?
So yeah, initially it was just me and Russell. We used to have a designer as well when we first started. When we both left our full-time jobs, our designer decided that he couldn't do that. He couldn't take the risk. But now we've kind of grown, and we now have there's three employees with us as well. So we have Chris, oh, wow, who's a designer. We've also got Monica, who does like admin and support, and we've just taken on another developer who's like a graduate, with the aim to kind of help us out with some of the development work we do.
Excellent.
Nice. So one question, like being an indie shop, one of the biggest difficulties, especially if it's like your own app that's basically bringing sort of like winning the bread, is deciding what features go in and what features don't go in, right? So even if you take Pocket Casts, for example, in the latest update, like we said, it's a fantastic update. There are like some brilliant features that I most definitely will ask you a little more on a little later. But here's one quick question. I know like with Pocket Casts, there is an option to change themes, right? Like just change the appearance of the app. Now, that is a great feature, but it's probably not as core to the app as some of the other sort of like features, right? But you thought it was important enough to add that feature in. So how is it that you make these decisions? Like what is the process in deciding that feature?
Yeah, it's definitely very difficult because you don't want to add too many features to your app that becomes more confusing. The more you add, the more users going to get lost in your app. So trying to keep the app simple is definitely hard work because the more features you add, the more maintenance you have as well down the track. So the way we decide is, I guess we get a lot of feedback from users. So they email us or they send us tweets. And you tend to, if it's something that people really want, you'll hear about it more and more.
Mm-hmm.
You don't even necessarily need to record it, because if you're getting people email you, you'll remember because it constantly come up. So we definitely take that into account. So that's something that we bear in mind. It doesn't mean we don't necessarily put them straight in the app. You know, maybe a couple of years down the track, you know we might add it, but essentially we might not need to do it now. But things like, we add features where we don't even personally want ourselves. So we've got variable speed playback, and I can't actually listen to podcasts at variable speed. It just doesn't work for me. But that's enough people wanted it, so we saw that we should add that in. That's a feature that would be good. Well, I guess one of the main things is, if you create an app that you use as well, and use it, we use like Pocket Casts daily, you see what kind of is wrong with the app or what's missing. And that's kind of what I think one of the best indicators as to what you should add in the future, I think, personally.
What was one of the things when you launched immediately that you realized, or, you know, it could be immediately or even within the last 6 months, that you realized, wow, this feature is totally missing, or I totally messed this up, or we need to change this? Is there anything that comes to mind?
Well, a lot of the time it's actually just trying to keep up with, you know, how quick Google are moving. So, you know, the Chromecast came out and we're like, oh, this will be great for podcasting. You can watch it on your TV. We can keep recording progress on the TV. This is brilliant. We'll have to add this. And then they come out with Material Design. We're like, oh, this is great. This will make our app look awesome. Let's do this next. So a lot of the time it's just kind of keeping up. And now Google I/O is coming just around the corner. I'm sure there's going to be new features that we're going to want to add as well.
Now, you brought up a good point of variable playback, and I think back in the early days of podcasts when I first hopped on board, variable playback was used in kind of, I guess, with an integration with another app. Is that correct?
Yeah, initially it was done, people wanted it, and there was no way to do it actually kind of through the OS, but there was a library called Presto.
Yeah.
So they had an app in the store that you could use. But the problem with that is, I think our app was about $4, but their app was about $6, so you'd be paying more than the price of the app for an extra feature. So we decided that, like down the track, that we should actually kind of change that. So we integrated our own library, which was kind of a C library. And then recently with Pocket Casts 5, we've used kind of the Android kind of API to do that.
Oh, nice. Excellent. So now, if I were, let's say I was a developer, and I get this question all the time. If I were a developer and I wanted to be an indie app developer for maybe my own products, what tips would you have for anyone who wanted to do that?
So, yeah, go and work for yourself. I think teaming up is a good one. So me and Russell teamed up from kind of the start, and it means you can kind of bounce ideas off each other. You can tell each other, you can be honest with each other and tell each other if it's kind of a silly idea, rather than you kind of going down a track and you've got no one to work with. I think that really works for us. Another one would be, if you're going to do indie app development, design's very important, I think, especially now with the new material. Everyone likes a good-looking app. If you're a programmer, maybe try and get a designer to help you out with that. You don't have to be good at everything. You know, you can use other people to help you get there, I think.
So give us like teaming up with people and then like getting stuff working together. So can you give us like what a typical day looks like for you in an indie shop? So if like I was to work in an indie shop, like what time do you get in? How do you like get stuff done? Like how do you work with Russell? Like how do you work with your designer? Do you guys have like an iteration? Like what's your process like?
So we're quite flexible here at Shifty Jelly. I guess that's our whole idea. We're working for ourselves, so we don't want to be tied into that corporate way of you have to be in by a certain time, you have to leave by a certain time. So we flexible working hours are big for us. So we say core hours are like 10 till 4, and we try and stick to that as well, because that's kind of, you definitely need to be in the same office as someone, I feel, to get, if you're working on a design or a product, because you can quickly like talk to each other rather than, I think remote, we try to work remotely from home, and it wasn't quite as quick as we'd like. So we try and all get in the office by that certain time. And we, with our process, with our developing our apps, we'll often get together and we'll sit around and we'll talk about kind of where we're going next and what we think, you know, should be what we should add. And the designer will go away and try and take what we've kind of all agreed on and kind of come up with some initial designs. And from there, kind of, we'll just iterate through that. We'll bounce ideas off each other. Like the designer might show us something, we say, well, that doesn't quite work how we think maybe it needs to. And it will just be we're constantly iterating until we come up with something that we're all happy with. It's funny, you think maybe working for yourself, it'll be it'll be less stressful, but I think sometimes it's more stressful. I did a piece for Mac Stories, and they wanted a diary for a week. And I actually did 60 hours that week. So rather than doing your normal like job, which is maybe 40, I kind of did a job and a half. But
wow.
But I guess that's part of being kind of, if you're running your own business, that's comes with the territory, I think.
No, that's a good question. What's the hardest part for working for yourself that you would say?
I guess it's not just doing the programming. Kind of that's what where your passion is. But you're now running a business as well. So you know you have lots of other little things to do. You have to arrange office space. You're managing finances. You've got employees to manage as well now. So all those are little things, but they all add up. You know, some days I find haven't done anything for half a day and I wonder where it's all gone. And it's just kind of all that little management kind of task. And I think that's the reason why we don't want to grow more than we are now. Like we're a comfortable size. And if we get any bigger, you know, I'm going to be taken away from the reason I started doing this, which is, you know, programming Android and kind of that side of it. The other thing as well is probably you're constantly thinking about it. So I go home and I can't stop myself thinking about kind of our company and where we're going next and what we've done today and what we're going to do tomorrow. So there's an added pressure, I think. And you're bringing money now, so if you start employing people, you've got to be paying their wages. So there's that stress of, are you going to have enough money? And I guess it gets easier as the longer you do it, because the more you do it, the more you know there's money always going to be coming in at the end of the month with your next app sales. But yeah, early days, that's kind of worrying. You know, we've had the months where its bank balance has got down to zero. We've laughed about it, but we know there's money coming in, so it's okay. But yeah, it's definitely, there is a stress to it as well.
Yeah, it's hard to leave a lot of that stuff at home when you work for yourself, because, I mean, leave that stuff at the office, because when you leave, that stuff's still in your head. Even if you're commuting home, you're thinking about it when you're cooking dinner or when you're washing the dishes, or that free moment that you're not doing anything, all of a sudden an idea pops into your head and you're thinking about work. And so I can definitely relate. I've been down that road myself.
I think the positives outweigh the negatives by far. So
oh, yes.
Getting to do what I want to do. And when you can create whatever you want to create, tomorrow we can decide that we're going to do a whole new app, and there's really no one to stop us. You know, that's our decision, which is great.
The photo filter app market is wide open.
I want to do another flashlight.
Yes. So, let's talk a little bit about Pocket Cast tech stack. I know that a lot of people think when they get into app development, like, I'm going to have this app and I'm going to build this app and it's going to be killer. It's going to do all these great things. The thing that they don't realize is usually the app is just the client. It's just the user interface client component of it. And I know that Pocket Cast is probably the same way. You guys have a back-end server that you guys use. Is that correct? And if so, what is it used for?
Yeah, we've always seems to do that. We always end up kind of adding a server component to our apps. We can never do like a simple like flashlight application. It becomes something really complex. So yeah, with Pocket Cast, we have the server kind of component as well, which was kind of big. So we, in there, we actually parse all the podcasts. So our idea initially was, you know, if you open your device and it takes like 2 minutes to refresh all your podcasts, that's not a good experience. Mm-hmm. So if we can do that on the server, and then you open your app and you have to make one call to our server and it gets all the updates, it seems like a much better user experience. So our server is actually parsing podcasts all the time, so keeping them up to date and then pushing out those episode updates when they arrive.
So how does that work from a client app perspective? Does Pocket Cast simply go up to your guys' server and say, hey, here is the list of podcasts that I listen to. Are there any new updates? And then you guys kind of give a thumbs up or a thumbs down. And if it's a thumbs up, then you just kind of send back the file location and the client downloads the file? Or how does that work?
Yeah, so we do kind of, rather than if you were going to update using a kind of a normal process, you'd get the full XML file, you'd parse it to see what you're missing. But now we know what you've got, the latest one you've got, the episode you've got, we send that to server, we say, is there anything new? And then we send them down just that kind of the short, just this one episode's updated, here's the details you need. So it's a much quicker experience for the client.
I remember an online conversation at some point. So there's this other developer who goes by the name Marco Arment, and he has like another podcasting app on the iOS platform. I remember
I've never heard of him.
Who's that guy?
I have to look him up. I'm not sure.
So I remember him mentioning that basically there was this point where this guy is basically used old school PHP stuff. So at one point he used PHP for sort of like processing, like running background jobs. And it was precisely for what we were just talking about. It was like on the server end, you basically want to be running processes or jobs and basically sort of do like check for the updates, keep parsing, keep shooting out calls to wherever the different podcasts are hosted, pull their feeds, and then only give the client information depending on which podcast it actually has to download. And so that makes it pretty fast because all of this is pushed to the server side. And I remember like there was this big sort of thread going on where he started with PHP and then that was like blowing up his server. So then he tried to use Go or something, use Go for like the processing. And I remember along those lines, he mentions that, hey, one of the folks at Pocket Cast said like, well, you can even use Java. And we actually use Java for these background services and it works perfectly well. Is that true? Am I remembering that correctly?
That's right. So I guess I've always listened to Marco's stuff. Like I listened to Build and Analyze when that was out. And I really like his style. Like he's a bit of the rock star programmer, isn't he? So it was interesting to see him come along and do what we did as well. So it was interesting to hear how he had the same kind of problems and how he approached them as well. Because that was very similar to us. We tried it one way. We tried it, you know, with Ruby initially, and we had some scaling problems with that. So we decided to write it in Java because that's, I guess, me being an enterprise Java developer, that's what I know. So it was actually dealing with threads, dealing with XML. I've been doing that for a long time, so that made sense to actually try that in Java. And that's something that Java's really good at, so that has worked out really well for us.
How does that work exactly? So do you have like pure Java executable runners sort of like on a cron job or something, or like something along those lines? I mean, how does it precisely work? Like if I had to write something like that, would I write like a Java, straight up Java program with a public static void main kind of thing and then have that run on a cron job?
Yeah, that's basically what we do. We just have multiple nodes. We have multiple kind of those running out on servers that are constantly parsing data. They get fed kind of the feeds they need to parse, and they'll go off and they'll check to see if there's anything new, then let the kind of the main kind of servers know what's happening.
Nice. And do you also use like a sort of Java framework, like a web framework? We're going to probably talk about like the web client as well, which I'm not sure how many people know about it, but the web client is actually pretty awesome that Pocket Casts had, but it's probably in beta or something. So how much of like the backend server stuff, like do you use like a Java web framework? Do you use like Spring or one of those other things? Or what are the different kind of Java frameworks that you use, I guess is my question.
We've really tried to avoid that. I guess, you know, that's, we used to do JSP and JSF, and while that is good for enterprise, I've enjoyed doing other different languages. So I've tried Ruby on Rails, and I find that an excellent like web framework for quickly like doing that interface between the kind of mobile device and the server. Mm-hmm. Also, for anything else to do with the web, I think Ruby on Rails has got that kind of nailed. So we still use that today, Ruby on Rails, and that works, you know, fine. People say that maybe it's slow, but there's ways to scale that you don't need to worry about that. I don't feel. And I think Marco still uses PHP, so it's,
yeah.
It sometimes it's not about kind of what language you use, but how you implement it, I think.
Mm-hmm.
That's a very good point, yeah.
Yeah. How do you guys decide what work gets done on the server versus what gets done on the client? Do you have any heuristics that you follow for that kind of stuff?
Oh, beautiful question.
I think, well, the main reason we do the podcast parsing on the server is we know that that's, you know, quite an intensive thing for a phone to do, to constantly parsing. Say you've got 100 podcasts, you don't want that to be, you know, calling 100 servers and downloading the XML for all of those servers. If you've got a mobile device and it's got, you know, you're worried about battery, you're worried about kind of the interface speed, it just seems like it's the wrong place to do it. We do the same with our Pocket Weather application. We have a server for that, and that parses all the weather data from all the different locations. So when you call that, it then gives you that data compressed into just what you need. You don't need anything more than that. And it seems to work quite well for mobile applications.
Excellent. Now, for you guys' server components, do you guys host this on just maybe a co-located space? Do you use AWS, or what do you guys use?
Yeah, we still use the virtual private servers. So we most of ours are on, I think, Linode at the moment. So we've moved them around depending. Like, obviously, we do an Australian weather app, so we were trying to get to close to Australia as possible, because that's, you know, the lowest latency possible. We haven't gone down the Amazon Web Services or that side of things yet. I always find it hard to figure out how much it's actually going to cost. If you buy like a virtual private server, you know that's a fixed amount. I can increase it. I can buy 32 gigabytes of RAM if I want to. Mm-hmm. Whereas if it's with a service which is billing me for the amount I use, it kind of worries me that I'm going to get a bill for like $10,000 at the end of the month.
Exactly. So now, another thing that I really like about Pocket Casts, and I found this by accident actually a couple years ago, is the sync feature between my devices. So if I have, let's say I have a tablet at my house that sits in a dock, and I have my phone that I drive around with and listen to in the car and while I'm doing dishes and stuff, if I press play on a podcast and I'm saying I'm listening to like the Tim Ferriss podcast, and then I'm halfway through and then I go to my tablet, and I can start the podcast directly where I left off on my phone. So it looks like there's some type of sync feature built between or built into the app somehow. How difficult was that to build?
Yeah, that definitely was tricky, because obviously if some devices can go offline, then they'll come back online later. It's definitely like, it's been done before a lot of places, so there's a lot of help online to give you advice, but there's something you need to test with. And we had a few issues early on that we've kind of ironed out since. We've done some things to kind of help us along the way. So I've got kind of an admin area where I can turn on logging, so I can see for a particular user, if they're having troubles, what they're sending to us and what we're sending back. So if they've got multiple devices, we can then, that made us much easier to like debug that problem.
Okay. Now, do you guys use anything like the Android backup service at all to do anything like that?
No, we've kind of stuck to our own server, and the main reason is that we're cross-platform.
Okay.
So we're on Android, we're on iOS, we're on Windows Phone, we're on the web. So we've never tried to tie ourselves into one of those. I'm sure it's very good. I haven't actually looked at it, but if you're doing a smaller application, it's probably a good thing to do, to have a look at those kind of things, because it's kind of obviously less cost, less server maintenance. It just seems like you wouldn't have to write anything for the server side. So if you can utilize that, why wouldn't you? But if you're going to go cross-platform, maybe you need to do your own thing.
Since you guys are cross-platform, and to be honest, this is the first time I've thought of this, if I had an iPhone and I had Pocket Cast app on my iPhone, and I listen to a Pocket Cast or a podcast on my iPhone, and then I went to my Android phone and I was logged into the same account. Would they be synced across devices and platforms too?
Yeah, so we sync your podcast, and we also sync your play position, so where you're up to,
yep.
Whether you finished it. And so that works across all of them. So,
so awesome.
That works on the Chromecast as well. So kind of yesterday I was working on Chromecast for our web app, so you can Chromecast from the browser. So that also works. So you can be playing on your television, and that'll be constantly syncing back to the web as well.
I do that in my bedroom, actually. We have a flat screen in our bedroom, and I'll just put a Pocket Cast up there and just play podcasts while I'm in my room, just like cleaning or whatever. Love it.
It seems like the Chromecast is quite popular now. It's getting even more popular.
While we're on the subject, I think this is like a very good time to talk about like the web client. Do you want to like sort of give us a small pitch on that, Phil?
Yeah, sure. So our idea was that basically with the, you have your mobile device, but then when you get to your desktop, we could be writing like native kind of app for Windows and for the Mac and for Linux. But at the end of the day, wherever you are, you have a web browser. So it makes sense that if you want to continue listening, you know, we can sync all your podcasts, where you're up to, and everything to your browser. So when you get to work, you can just put your phone down and then continue straight off. And it's actually done quite well for us. We weren't sure whether many people would use it, but it's taken off. I think we need to work on our marketing because it seems like lots of people don't know about it. And also, I think marketing with features as well, like you're saying you didn't really know about sync, but that's been in there for quite a while. It's just us letting people know when we add new features is quite important, I think.
So for you guys have the web player, you have your back-end servers, you have Java stuff, looks like, I remember you said something about Ruby and maybe Rails. You have various different components. How do you guys monitor your back-end? Do you guys use any type of error tracking service, or is there anything you guys have built externally so you guys can be notified like via pager if something goes down? How do you guys handle that?
Yeah, so there's quite a few different solutions, isn't there, on the web for doing this? But the one we use is I use Pingdom.
Okay.
So what I've done is I've got on different servers. I might have a web service that will say whether it's like okay or failed, and in the back end I'll do some logic to say, is it parsing slowly or is this bit of the service down, and then Pingdom will just send me a message as soon as that says failed. So it's not only just looking to see if the website's there, but it's also does some kind of testing as well as part of that. So.
Okay. And how much would you guys say, of your time that you spend developing, because it seems like you guys have a lot of spinning wheels at once. You have the back end, you have the client apps and so forth. How much of your time is spent working on the back end versus working on the client apps?
I guess in the early days of when we've been writing apps, initially you're writing a lot of the server component, but it seems now these, like towards the end of the project, not end of the project, but towards when it's more mature, you are more working on the client and the user interface and the features. I don't want to jinx it, but I haven't touched a podcast in parsing for a while now. So that now and again, there'll be small fixes I need to do, but it's fairly stable. Now I've said that, it's going to fall over. but it seems like once you've got that structure and that data store set up, it's more about maintaining the client apps and improving them.
Do you guys use like a relational store in the background, or do you guys use a big data like Mongo type of store?
I use some different ones actually. What have I got? I've got MongoDB for part of it. I've got MySQL for or MariaDB for other parts of it.
Interesting.
So, just at the time, what feels right, I think.
Excellent. And so, if you had to kind of say, I mean, this kind of crosses both boundaries from client apps to server side applications. What's probably some of the most challenging technical problems you've had to face while building or maintaining Pocket Cast?
Well, I guess. You always make assumptions, don't you, when you start a project. I think initially we thought, there'd be about 2,000 podcasts. That's all we need to handle. and then as soon as you kind of hit 100,000 podcasts, you're like, oh, where did all these come from? So I guess you have to constantly keep that up to date and see what the bottlenecks are and what your assumptions you made were actually wrong and fix them as you go along. But that's the advantage of doing it. Once you get to do it full time, I can spend a whole day trying to fix one of these problems rather than doing it in the evening.
Exactly. Was there any technical problem in particular that you remember just being just a real bear to conquer and fix?
Oh, the parsing was definitely one of those things where, I rewrote the whole lot because it just wasn't working. It wasn't scaling quick enough. Things like that, you don't realize until it comes along and all of a sudden you're I have these problems. I guess one of the common ones on Android was kind of the variable speed playback. We wrote that 3 times.
Oh, wow.
You try one way and it's not quite working, or it didn't work on Intel devices properly for us, and you just have to keep trying it again. And if you have to throw it away, at least you've got kind of a base to work off, but then just try it again. We often, with new versions of apps, we'll just throw everything away. Like with the iOS version, we might like throw away all the code and just start from fresh again, because you find by throwing stuff out, maybe you remove some features which they're not really needed in there, and it kind of cleans it up as well. So
that's pretty interesting, though. Like, I mean, when I thought about it, I would imagine that XML parsing is like a solved problem, right? Like, what should be that difficult about it? But the more I've read about it online, I realize it isn't that simple, because it's not just about like parsing at one time. I'm guessing it's the scale that makes this problem more of a sort of nasty affair, isn't it?
Yeah, you don't want to be, if you don't have to parse a whole XML file, you can try and avoid it. It's probably a good thing. But this is a kind of, not a, XML is kind of a standard, but what goes into it isn't. So podcast authors can do whatever they like in this file. We got podcast authors who will have the same kind of episode URL for every single one, or they won't put a date in. So what do you do if there's no dates in the, there's just little
edge
small
cases.
Problems that come, edge cases, or they won't order it. So you think, oh, maybe I can just parse one part of the file. They'll just put them in any order they like, or they'll put some funny characters which aren't valid in XML. So your parse will fall over, and constantly trying to fix those kind of issues, I guess.
You mentioned the playback speed, and that's like a good segue into like sort of some of the audio effects. So actually, I think that's what you call it on Pocket Cast, right? In the blog post that you had, there were these features that are called audio effects. And I'm not sure if listeners even like know about this, but this is like some pretty amazing stuff. The features you have is like pretty amazing. One thing is basically the auto silence removal thing. And just to give listeners a quick gist on how this works, this is like my understanding as a user. And then Phil, you can probably come in and tell me if I'm completely incorrect about how it actually works. So if you have a podcast and you have someone who like, there's a silence in your podcast. Typically, for people who are listening to podcasts, you don't want to maybe go through the whole silence. So there's an option where like you can actually, like Pocket Casts can basically just like remove that silence off for you. I imagine this would be very tricky, because with audio files, there isn't anything like absolute silence. Or more often than not, there isn't absolute silence. There's going to be a slight background sort of hum. So how exactly did you managed to pull that feature off? Did you have to have like some knowledge about how like audio engineering works? Did you have like some special API? You did mention like some C libraries. Was that, how complicated a feature was that to implement?
So we only brought this in the recent version of Pocket Cast. So this is now the actual Google APIs have improved. So it's no longer, we have to write it as a C library. So that's one big advantage initially. One other advantage of working with other people is that I actually got Russell to do this, which was good. So he volunteered while I was doing all the materials kind of features. He did the audio effects. So I'm not going to expert on this area, but I can tell you roughly by looking through the code and talking to him about it, how he did it. So there's formulas to figure out with the audio samples when there's no talking. You obviously never get quite dead silence, but it's good enough that you know that there's no one talking. I think there's quite a lot of difference between that. With these, there's formulas to kind of help you figure that out. So that's how we've added that. There's also some of the other audio effects, like the loudness enhancer. There's actually, those are kind of built in now from, I think it was KitKat onwards. They've started adding these to the APIs, and that really kind of helped us out as well. So that's probably why we hadn't done it up till now.
Very interesting. And for the remove silence bit, so you basically say, oh, if the volume is above a certain threshold or if it's below a certain threshold on an average compared to the file in general, so then that's you assume that to be a silence? Or is there like an API that says, is it silent? So, I mean, you know, something along those lines.
So you get given the audio samples to when the media player is processing it, that you can deal with the samples yourself and do whatever you like with them, remove them, or change them. So what we do is just process those audio samples and use formulas on those to figure out whether those samples they've given us are silence or are, you know, talking.
Oh, interesting. So there's like something called, the sound pause is something that the API provides to you as the media player, as you proceed, it says like, okay, I'm in a period of sound pause or something.
No, not so much. So it's like, I guess if you're extracting kind of a zip file or something, you're getting a stream of constant data. We're getting a stream of constant audio samples to process, and we process them and we can do what we like with them.
Ah, okay. That makes
sense. We can ignore them. We can just drop them and get rid of them.
Perfect. Yeah. And with regards to like the volume boost feature that you were saying, so it's not necessarily just boosting the overall track, right? Like you're boosting only the voices specifically. Is that correct?
Yeah, so some of these actually built in. So you've got the equalizer and stuff built into kind of Android where you can use and you can change it to make it sound better with talking. Because I guess we've got the advantage that the most podcasts are to deal with talking, and the user can turn this on and off. So if it affects their podcast, like their music podcast, they can turn this off. Like you wouldn't want the silence removal in a music podcast. That wouldn't make any sense.
And you were talking about the Android APIs being pretty good. Now, this is actually interesting because like I believe recently, and I'll add a link to the show notes as well, some people have said that latency is like a huge problem specifically with the Android APIs. Now, I don't know how much this affects sort of like a podcast app, but I remember like in the initial days, I'll add a link to this as well. So there's this YouTube video of like Jimmy Fallon, and like in his like Tonight Show, basically he has Billy Joel come onto the show, and together basically they have like this iOS app where they have, it's called Looper. So basically they can build on loops and like they do a sort of live rendering of a song, and that got me like super interested because I am like pretty interested about like sound engineering in general. So I was like, hey, okay, I'm going to try to do this like on Android because I couldn't find an Android app. But the APIs were actually very hard. I mean, it was not very easy to deal with. So when you say that the Android APIs like now for sound, like for the audio stuff is actually pretty good, that like sort of surprises me. I mean, granted, you're like probably 20 times a better developer as well. But
Russell did this, so he's the one that's clever, maybe. I don't know when you tried, though, because they've definitely got better. They've definitely improved. So
yeah, this was maybe like 6 or 7 years back, I'm guessing.
Yeah, so I think Pocket Cast minimum now is Jelly Bean. So that's probably, that's the reason why, because it is definitely a difficult problem.
Interesting. So, but is latency ever a problem? Like, do you have to deal with that or is it not?
I guess we don't really, because we can process ahead of time. So
it's just playback. So right.
Yeah, it's playback. So that makes it a bit easier for us. But I haven't seen that video. I might have to take a look.
Oh yeah, it's an amazing video. it's pretty interesting. So if you're looking for a weekend sort of project, then go ahead and do it, because you guys can probably finish it off in a weekend.
Did you release your Looper app?
No, I didn't. I didn't get. I mean, this was like some time back, so I was like,
release it. Come on.
I gave up on the project halfway. I was like, yeah, this is not worth the effort. I'll wait for somebody else to do it. So
this could be your big break.
Yeah, I know.
This could be you going indie.
Make sure you write tests though.
Oh yeah. Oh, obviously.
What are they?
I think that goes hand in hand right now with Android.
all right. Okay, so yeah, I'll definitely add a link to basically all of that in the show notes. Now, moving on more centrally towards like taking the focus on the Android app specifically, do you guys use third-party libraries?
Well, we started off using not very many, because I don't think I even used like Butterknife. I was really kind of like trying to stick with the way Android did it, and I thought while I'm learning, it's probably the best thing to do is to stick with kind of the default kind of way of using it. But recently I've started to use more and more libraries. It was actually quite funny, like I listened to your image loading podcast. You're talking about kind of how to implement it in different ways, and the day before I just finished converting from Android Universal image loading library to the Picasso one, and I found that Picasso library amazing. So I definitely am adding more and more libraries in now, just if we need to. You know, if they do, there's a lot of good libraries out there now. Like, it never used to be the case, but a lot of people are sharing their code, and you get, as a small company, you get quite a big advantage if people are offering like code that you'd have to write yourself. You know, you're saving time by doing that. And we use other libraries like a lot of the Google Play Services ones. So we've got podcasts on the watch. So they have the Wear kind of Play Services library, but also the Chromecast one. A few of the material design ones as well. Like we wanted to try and port back as many kind of the material features as we could. So there's a few of them as well. The material designers, they seem to have said this is the way we want to do it, but the APIs aren't up to that level yet. So a few other people have stepped in, like with the like material dialogues. There's a really good library online I can maybe add to the show notes as well that we use. The snack bar like pop up from the bottom. So if someone makes a change, you can easily undo it. We use the library for that as well. So there's a few different ones. And vectors as well. We've started with the material design. I was adding vectors, but that isn't backwards compatible. So we use some libraries to help us put those in as well.
Do you use Dan's library at all from Dan Liu? He created the, what's it called?
Victor. Yeah.
Victor. Oh, no. Ooh, I use Mr. Vector.
Mr. Vector. Okay. Mr.
Vector. Sounds very professional, doesn't it?
sounds like a bubble bath or something like that, you know?
There's so many libraries out there now, it's hard to find the best ones, but Mr. Vector worked well for me.
Cool. Right on.
You talked about like the most difficult task overall in general, but like specifically for the Android client, what was like probably the hardest thing to implement in Pocket Casts? Do you remember like a specific sort of niggle or like maybe a task?
Auto download was always quite difficult. Like in the early days, we handed it off to the system to download, and it never quite worked for us. So we ended up kind of writing that ourselves. Playback was obviously a massive one for us because you're playing audio back. So on your different devices, you have different problems, and we've got video and audio. That's always tricky. So, and Bluetooth. Wow, we get so many emails about Bluetooth.
Oh, yes.
Not my favorite support emails to answer.
And that must be pretty hard because Bluetooth is something that people probably use a lot, right? Like, I mean, if you're trying to link it up to your car or something, like while you're driving and you want like Bluetooth sort of streaming.
Yeah, it's very difficult. Yeah, you've got Bluetooth headphones they've become quite popular, and in your car, also Bluetooth as well.
Yeah, I mean, sure, it makes sense. And like the Android app, like I think we've already said 3 or 4 times, like the material design update is just so nice. There are like some niceties that I'm not sure like everyone has noticed. Like, for example, the navigation drawer, like if you open up Pocket Cast right now and if you see the navigation drawer, like it's so nice. Like you have like this collage of like the images of like all the podcasts that you have like laid out in like one sort of slanting a collage in the background, and then like you have the Pocket Cast sort of like icon, and as it's like refreshing or doing a sync, then you have both of those two tiny circles like go in like with a parallax sort of rotation. It's the level of detail that's gone into designing and like building this app is fantastic. It's just like such an excellent example.
I think what we wanted to do, because obviously material is all about design, we wanted to just try and put that extra effort in, and maybe, you know, it's not a feature you'd think of straight away, adding a collage of your podcast images, but it's just something that can add to the app to give it, when people notice it, that kind of stands out. So like the refresh with the two circles refreshing, that was something that just kind of adds a little bit of class maybe. And it's actually really fun to do. I quite like doing little animation. It always makes me laugh when I do the animation and it flies off the screen or, you know, does the wrong thing. But that's something that we enjoy adding, like some nice kind of niceties to the app, like you say.
Yeah. And you did you make use of like the Palette API for doing all of like, you know, like one thing that's immediately obviously evident is like depending on the sort of artwork for each podcast, like you have the background sort of like, and this is one of the big sort of sells like in Google I/O, or at least like for the whole Lollipop update, right, is like using the palette to sort of like draw out the primary color components. But you used the Palette API specifically?
Yeah, so actually, before that came out, we were using our own library. So we were picking out colors from the artwork and using it. And then when Google brought their own version out, we switched over to theirs. But we do some custom kind of things with that. So we kind of pick our own kind of colors in those spectrum. But it seems to work really well. I think it adds a bit more character doing that. It's interesting with that material update. There's lots of different little elements that kind of add to the overall effect, like they've got the elevation now, so you can like bring up layers They've got one thing I really liked is the vectors where you can animate them. So I spent quite a bit of time doing the pause to the play button to a pause button, so it animates.
Yes.
And they take care of quite the complex stuff for you. So you define the points for both shapes, and they animate them for you. So it makes your job a lot easier, but it adds some class to it. It looks really nice. So I think Android or Google have done a really good job with the new material designs.
I think the first initial, when the new app came out and the material design was present, and I hit the play button and I saw it transform into a pause button, it was one of the nice little tiny things that you guys did on the app that really made it pop. Because when I saw it, I was like, oh, that's awesome. And even though, like, if I was to say that in front of my wife, she'd be like, you are so stupid. You know? But it's so cool that it does that. And the same thing happens, like, if you have the device, and if you have the Pocket Cast app installed, look at it in a portrait environment and then turn it to a landscape, and you'll actually see the podcasts reorder themselves, kind of like they'll go into their correct locations. Now, when you did that, was that through like a recycler view or through a custom view, or how did you do that?
Well, it's been interesting. We've been trying to keep the project up to date, because obviously things are always changing. Recycler view is kind of the new kind of hotness, and we've been trying to get rid of list view. And there's a lot of people kind of with examples on the internet on how to make the recycler view do all these kind of animations, and it makes it much easier now. Because list view, that I don't think that was even possible to do that kind of thing, or I couldn't find an easy way to do it. So, now we've switched over. That's a recycler view. We've switched over all episode list to recycler view. And I think that's definitely a step forward, I think, personally.
Did you find, in your experience with recycler view, because there's a lot of people in the situation that you guys were in that had list views and they want to go to recycler view, were there any challenges that you found that were kind of weird going from list view to recycler view?
Yeah, definitely. Like our biggest crash in our current version is to do with recycler view, and their previous version is to do with recycler view. And I think that's still, there's still definitely some issues that are happening there, but it's once you see kind of what you can do with like animations, and now we've got a swipe happening as well, so you can swipe to mark as played. It's definitely worth the switch, but there is some ironing out you need to do. And if you're going from list view to recycler view, it's obviously a lot harder than if you're starting from a fresh. It's almost, I almost should have just like thrown some of the screens away and just started from scratch again, I think, because trying to translate them introduced some bugs, I think.
Yeah, because I know there's a lot of people, even at the user group I run, that are trying to make that transition. And so I guess you're saying is like maybe take a look at the list view and see if it may be worth just kind of starting from scratch again then, huh?
Yeah, I think rather than trying to port it across, it's much easier to just start from afresh. Because there's different ways they work. You know, with the adapter, you can get the position in the adapter now, and there's other, or the view holder. So, yeah, but it's definitely worth a switch if you can do it. I find as well I can't do both. I've had to switch everything to recycler view. I can't have some list views and some recycler views.
Yeah. For the Pocket Cast app in general, where do you guys see the future of this app going? And the reason why I bring this question up is for those of you that, and you're probably familiar with this, listen to the Startup Podcast, which is by Alex Bloomberg, I think it is. He's from This American Life and so forth. He started a company called Gimlet, which is based around developing high-quality podcasts. And during the interviews and that, in his various episodes, one of the investors had said, hey, look, you know, there's a problem with podcasts. I can't share them. I can't say, hey, listen to this particular segment that has super interesting content. I can't share that piece. And it seems to be an open hole and kind of in the podcast market. So I was always interested to think of like, well, if there's anyone that could possibly have a foothold in the market, it's the Pocket Cast crew. Where do you guys see the future of the Pocket Cast app going?
Yeah, that's a hard one, isn't it? Because it seems like now podcasts have really taken off. So, you know, anyone can come up and create a podcast and play it to the rest of the world. So I think there's lots of little small companies now doing stuff to do with podcasts for authors, or they're doing it for clients. Obviously, I think we're more focused towards the listeners rather than the podcast authors, but there's definitely things that we want to try that we've got down the track, you know, to help maybe podcast authors, or to do things like you say, you know, sharing as well, sharing segments, that kind of path. But it's obviously very hard. You want to add features to your app, but you don't want to make it more complicated. So would you do it as a new app or a new feature or a new site? It's kind of open at the moment.
Now, you guys have one of the most popular, you know, apps, or one of the more popular apps on the Google Play Store. And I can only imagine with your guys' popularity comes a lot of support requests. How do you guys handle that, those support requests? Do you use something like desk.com or Zendesk or anything like that for managing support requests?
Yeah, we recently switched over to using Groove. I don't know if you've heard of that one, but it so it just helps us kind of group them together. So if the same person is having like a problem, it kind of groups them by the user, so you can see the all of them coming in. We definitely get a lot of emails. Like I think it was yesterday, the day before, we had 500 in the inbox. So it is a full time job, and because of that, we've hired a person to help us out. So we've got Monica here, and she's kind of a support expert, and she goes through kind of the emails, and we also have obviously tweets coming at us, and we use Respondly for that. So I don't know if you've heard of Respondly. It's a similar kind of thing where you can assign them to certain people. So that's one of the other main reasons why we use Groove, is that if Monica sees something that maybe me or Russell or someone else in the company can look at, she'll assign it to us. And that works really well for us to kind of get through that huge amount of emails.
So other than like the humongous email influx that you guys get, what's probably the most challenging part of supporting your app?
Yeah, I guess trying to figure out what's the actual problem. Like some people will say my podcasts have stopped playing, and you know, that's only the small part of it you have to figure out. So we've done some things to try to kind of help with that. We've added, like, so if you email from inside the app, it will attach in like a debug attachment. And we add to that, so what podcasts you have in your collection, what episodes are having problems. So if you're having problems playing one, it will let us know what the error is on the device. And that really helps to help that user out. Otherwise, trying to repeat their problem, you need to get them to tell you exactly the same steps. Unless it's a common problem, it can often be quite hard. Like with the Bluetooth issues, if we don't have your Bluetooth device, or we haven't done it in the order that you've done, it's very tricky to solve, and we want to solve these problems, but sometimes it's near impossible.
With your guys, with the number of podcasts out there and the popularity of your podcasts, I can only imagine the weird podcasts that you guys run across, like the edge of the internet kind of stuff. It's just kind of like, wow, okay, I didn't know that kind of podcast existed, so that's interesting.
Yeah, sometimes they'll take their servers offline for a while and then bring them back, or they'll change to different URLs. But they'll just like inform their users through a website. So you have to kind of, if someone subscribed to this podcast feed, if they haven't set it up to redirect to the new one, that's going to be an issue. So there's always, I guess that's why there's so many emails. It's problems with their podcast, but also with the devices. And with Android, there's obviously a lot of devices. So.
Mm-hmm. Do you use like some tracking tool? Like, do you have like a third party sort of library that you, or like a framework or a service that you use for like tracking specifically? Or is it mostly just like in-house or like the kind of existing services that you have?
So what do you mean for tracking so support requests and stuff?
Yeah, I mean, if you're trying to like isolate a problem, and like, do you have any form of like tracking? Because I know there are like a couple.
Jira or Trello or something like that?
Yeah, so we do use Jira. So that's kind of, if it gets to the point where we need to do it now, or it's becoming a bigger task, we'll put it into Jira. That works quite well. If it's something that we can solve straight away, or we can add to like the to-do list for this week, we probably try and skip Jira. Otherwise, obviously that can grow and grow, and you'll end up with more than you can handle. So.
Come on, Kaushik, they're in Australia. They're going to use Jira. Anything Atlassian, right?
HipChat. Nice. And on the other side of like tracking, this just struck me. So like do you just like use Google Analytics and stuff like to sort of like get data on your users? Like, but if you want to support like a new device, or like, hey, this is like the biggest swath of like devices that we have, where do you get all that information from?
I guess our main way we do that is through the Google Developer Console, so the online. We haven't got analytics in our app as such. We think it's a little bit creepy. I don't know, like tracking every page you go to. I don't think that's really necessary. Like, but to know what devices really helps us. So what devices, what version of Android percentage people are using, that's really useful to us. So that's kind of the main way. And you can see in the developer console, it shows you like the number of kind of active users, and the people are like that kind of statistics. It was interesting. I actually had a look at this the other day, and we've got, it was 46% on Lollipop, which was like which is way more than, I think it was meant to be 10% of people have got Lollipop devices, but
I don't think it's 10%. I think it's lesser, yeah.
Is it even less? And there was the rest next was 35% was on KitKat. So, but then on Gingerbread was like 2%. So it's interesting to see the kind of active installs rather than what the phones are actually out there, I guess.
My only biggest gripe with like the Google or the data that's there on the developer console is like sometimes it isn't very accurate. For example, one thing we have found is like Google also gives you like the crash metrics, right? Like, so if you have an app, it gives you the list of crashes that have happened. And that's just like so far from like the truth. Like we have third party libraries like on the app that I work on. We have Crashlytics, and like if you see the number of crashes that come from Crashlytics versus what you actually see on the developer console, it's like ridiculously different. So that's why like sometimes I don't know how much you can trust the data.
You know why that is the case, right? Because those crashes are only reported if the user accepts to send the crash report.
Oh, right. That is true. So basically, invariably, if you say, no, I don't want to send anything, it doesn't go up.
Yeah, and so if users a lot of time will just ignore it, like, I don't care, because what happens is it introduces another interaction point for them to hop in the middle. So they say, yeah, I want to send it, and then their screen pops up, and it says, provide some notes. Most people are like, ah, screw this. I'll just restart the app.
Right.
We're the same. We use our hockey app, so if it crashes next time they boot the app up, it will send us the crash report.
Do you guys use a hosted version, or do you guys host it yourself?
No, we use it just their website. So we upload our mapping file to them as well, so we can easily see kind of the sat trace and the line numbers, and obviously the amount is the main thing. So
Nate, you had spoke a little bit earlier about the marketing of Pocket Casts and how you felt maybe you guys should market a few other things differently. At a higher level, how do you guys market your apps? Like, how do you go about doing that?
Well, yeah, I guess we need to market some more. It's kind of one of the main things as an indie developer. You realize you can create an amazing app, but if you don't market it, it's obviously people aren't going to know about it. It's really important. So the main thing we mainly do is the social marketing. So we do kind of like Twitter and Facebook and do a blog post, and that's free marketing. So that's obviously, if you're a small shop, that works quite well. But we've tried paid marketing. It never really kind of took off for us. So we have other ways. Like we talk to people who own blogs, and we try and get them involved. So we'll get them involved in kind of beta versions of our app, and they can test it out. And it gives some kind of word of mouth as well. So if you're on blogs and people are talking to you about your new app, it really kind of helps out with sales. And I feel sometimes people can get hung up on marketing in the early days.
Mm-hmm.
And you definitely need to do it once you've got a full product. But until it's there, you really need to make sure, you know, your app's of that quality, that high quality, and it's something that people are wanting to buy. Because you can do marketing, but it's got to be a good app at the same time. So it's got to be both.
Exactly. Now, I also noticed, I subscribed to a whole bunch of apps and lists, and I market my own stuff as well. And I don't believe I've ever been marketed by your team via email. And I'm kind of wondering why you guys haven't, or is it just something you guys are getting to, or what's the thought process on that?
Yeah, we've always thought about we probably should have done the opt-in to marketing emails. But I never really like those kind of spammy emails I kind of get in my inbox. But it would make sense to try and help out with marketing new products. So, for example, our web app no one really knows about, and that's probably our own doing by not being able to send people a message to say, hey, we've got this new app, you should really try it out. So I think in the future that's something we actually will do.
One of the things that we did while I was at Groupon and as well as MyFitnessPal is we used push notifications to help keep users engaged and also to bring them back into the application if they were gone for a while. I do know that you guys do use notifications to let me know when a new episode is downloading, and that's good. Do you guys use any other type of push notification technology to loop back in users to re-engage them at all?
No, we haven't really done that. So we found at the moment it's kind of enough. You've got a new episode coming out every week, or you've got a few, so one will come out every day. That's kind of a reminder that you've installed the app. The same with our weather app, you know, you'll get a push notification if there's like a severe weather warning. So that's kind of like an indirect way of getting people to be aware that your app's still installed and it's, you know, worth trying again.
Okay.
That makes sense. So this is all like amazing information. We're going to go into the awesome picks for the week. And Phil, why don't you start us off with your picks?
Yeah, sure. So my first one's kind of an Android pick. So there's a new tool that's been released for the Mac, and it just makes it easy to take screenshots and videos from your device. So it's a little Mac app that runs kind of in a window, and you can even do it across multiple devices. So if you've got two devices plugged in, you can pull off a screenshot from both of them. And I find that's quite a thing I'm doing regularly in the day, is taking a screenshot, sending it to a designer or sending it to someone else to have a look at, to see what they think. And if you take it on the phone, then you have to share it and email it. It's just it's an extra step that this tool saved me time as well. And it does a few other things. So you can run scripts, you can write your own scripts in there. For example, you can take bug reports from your phone as well. So that's quite handy. So that's my first pick. My second pick is to do with kind of indie development. So when we first got started, I read a book from 37 Signals. It's called Getting Real. So it's about they're very 37 Signals are very opinionated. So it's about their kind of decisions that they made along the way and their advice to you. So for example, one is less preferences. So in your app, you know, in the early days, make the tough decision. Instead of giving the user the option for the preference, make the choice initially, and then, you know, later down the track, you can add those preferences in, but you can often overcomplicate your app, you know, by adding like a million preferences. So that's a really good book to read if you're going to get started in the indie development.
Totally agree with that. I read 37 Signals, Getting Real years ago. I've been a big fan of Jason Fried and David Hanemeyer Hansen's work for a while, and their other books, Remote, and the other ones have been phenomenal. Big fan. So totally agree with that book. If you haven't checked it out, do so now. I'll go ahead and hop in with my picks at this point. I'm using, as of recently, a Chrome extension called Sidekick. It's by a company called HubSpot. And basically what it allows you to do is see when someone has opened your email. And I just tried this out as a test to see how useful it would be. And what I ended up finding out is it removed the psychological weight that I carried, the unknown psychological weight that I carried, of wondering, did so-and-so get that email? I have no idea if they got it. Well, now, because I never got a reply or anything like that, well, now I can see, as soon as I send it to him, I get a little notification in the in my Chrome extension saying, hey, you know, it looks like Kaushik opened the email. And so it's like, it's great. It's not like a creepy thing. It's just like, hey, all right, cool. I know that you got it. Don't worry. I'm not stalking you. I'm not outside of your window. Don't look right now.
So Don, the other day when you were saying Phil was not responding to the 500 emails we sent him, this is how you basically found out?
I was just ignoring you.
I'm just
kidding. See, I told you, like, I couldn't find him on Skype earlier, and I said, could you find him on Skype? And Couch said, yeah, I found him. And I said, I just think he blocked me. All right, the next pick I have is, I mentioned earlier, the Tim Ferriss Show, which is a great podcast for basically life hacking and so forth. And he recently interviewed Noah Kagan. Noah Kagan is the founder of AppSumo. He was also employee number 30 at Facebook and an early employee at Mint. So he has a lot of great knowledge. And he just dives super deep, super fast into just tons of all these hacks that he uses on a day-to-day basis, like how to follow up on email faster, how to make sure that you're eating correctly, how to make sure you're getting exercise in, how to make sure you're feeling great, breathing, etc. It's totally worth your time. Listen to it. It just came out on the Tim Ferriss Show. Next one is the Grammarly Chrome extension. I don't know if I mentioned this one before. I checked the show notes, didn't see it. It's basically a Chrome extension that makes sure that you don't look like an idiot when you're writing. So I may have written a few books, but my grammar is terrible, and so Grammarly helps save me from looking like more of an idiot before the internet proves me wrong. And then the last one I have is a blog post. It's called 10 Lessons from 4 Years of Working Remotely. And the author dives into how they have worked remotely for 10 years and for 4 years, and dives in and says, here's the 10 lessons that they've learned. Tons of great nuggets of information in there. One of them, which is key, which I totally believe, is the usage of emoticons cannot be overstated. And it sounds so weird to say that, but it's the truth. I've been working remote for 6 years, and when you're not there to see someone's body language, it's very hard to see and say to understand what they're saying to you. And text can be construed way differently. It could be construed of like, wow, this guy's being a total, you know, jerk. But he just is maybe making a statement and he's totally happy. And so adding that little smiley face at the end sometimes totally changes that little message. So
Check out that post if you work remotely or you think about it. And that's it for me.
So whenever you send an email saying you suck, always put a smiley face at the end.
That's what I do with you, right?
Yeah, yeah, all the time. Now I know what you're thinking. Now I don't think you're a jerk anymore.
No, I love you, man. I love you.
Okay, so these are my picks. So the first one is actually a blog post, and this is from an engineer at Facebook. So Sriram Ramani is his name. I'll put a link to the show notes. And he has like a couple of blog posts. The one that I found interesting was the one on custom view groups. And I thought it was pretty interesting. Custom views is essentially after, in the stage of Android development, you reach a certain point where you really have to know what custom views are and how it helps in optimization. So this is a nice post. It's a little basic. So if you're an advanced developer at this point, you probably already know it. But he has a way of explaining some of the concepts very well, and I really liked it. And he has a couple of other blog posts as well. So make sure you check it out. I really enjoyed. And the next one is probably one that everyone has heard of, heard about. This library is been like blowing up. It's called Leak Canary, and it's from the folks over at Square. So one of the biggest problems with Android development is memory leaks, and Don's personal favorite, which is OOMs.
Love those.
Yeah, I know. So typically the problem is it's very difficult to sort of diagnose your application and sort of zero in on where you have these leaks. You have to do like a whole bunch of steps, like get a heap dump, like get the profile, sort of like run a whole bunch of steps. What Leak Canary does is it makes it super easy. So you can just have it installed on your debug build, and you just keep using the app, and if it notices a memory leak at some point, it sends you a push notification. And when you hit the push notification, it'll open up this nice app where it'll actually give you an idea of where you have the references. And this is amazing. So I installed it on the Wedding Party app, and I was pretty confident that I wouldn't find anything. I didn't initially, but then when I ran our whole suite of automated tests, I realized at one point there was a leak, and like I just didn't catch it because like it was in a sort of like remote part of the app, and not many people, it didn't crop up that much, and because of that, it didn't really blow up. But Leak Canary sort of like immediately sort of like threw up that push notification. So absolutely, definitely check it out. This is, you will thank me. If you haven't heard of this library, you would absolutely enjoy it. It's like how when Don mentioned Stato, it's just immediately so useful. This is one of those things. I really think Google should at some point just like sort of have something built in that works exactly like this, because it's just so amazing for a developer.
Thank you,
Patrick. I think that's one thing that's missing in the developer tools is really some of these, something like this to kind of help us with our performance testing. There's definitely, they've got tools, but they're just not quite to that level yet where you can easily see where there's memory leaks or there are areas in your code that you can improve with performance problems.
All right, so it's time to sort of wrap up the show now. Do you have anything else you want to ask Phil, Don? I think I've asked like a whole bunch of things, and I'm very happy with like the sort of information we have today.
Oh, I think it's about lunchtime. What are you going to have for lunch?
Oh, tough decision. Look, outside our office, there's always food trucks that pop up. So we're going to have a look out there and see what there is. Normally, it's a burger van or something unhealthy like that.
Oh, wow. Sounds amazing.
Nice.
All right. So if listeners want to reach you, Phil, where's the best place they can do that?
So either on Twitter at GeekyGecko, or you can go to our website, which is shiftyjelly.com or pocketcast.com.
Excellent. And Don, if people want to reach you.
You can find me on Twitter at Don Felker. That's two N's, D-O-N-N. Or you can go to my website, donfelker.com.
Excellent. And if listeners want to reach me, I'm Kaushik Gopal. That's K-A-U-S-H-I-K-G-O-P-A-L on Twitter. And my website is kaush.co. That's kaush.co. You can find all the links and all the different information that we have talked about today in our show notes, and that would be at fragmentedpodcast.com/episodes/8. You can find all the information there. As always, you can send in feedback and comments at our Twitter account, which is fragmentedcast. Or you can just tweet directly at Don and me, and we'll get back to you. Please keep the comments and the feedback and the suggestions and the ideas coming, because we've been getting amazing feedback and we're super happy, because this basically gives us a lot of sort of ammunition to work with when we bring out the next few episodes. All right. Thank you so much, folks.
Thank you.
Thanks for having me.